First case on our calendar, 07705, Kenneth McFadden versus Cleveland State University. Mr. Fitzgerald.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Tim Fitzgerald, and I, along with Dennis Neerman, who's sitting with me at council table, are here this morning representing the appellant, Ken McFadden. We are asking the court to overrule and reverse the 10th District Court of Appeals decision in this case and remand the case so that an en banc session can be convened to resolve an intra-district conflict that has developed in the 10th District.
Is it necessary that there be an oral hearing, in your view, with all the members participating, or could this be resolved in a deliberative process in conference by members of the court?
The impaneling of an en banc session would require all judges of that court to participate in the conference and decision as to the actual defining of what the legal issue that
Where do you find authority that en banc must be done as an oral argument type presentation as opposed to a conference or administrative type situation with all members participating?
I don't think that it would necessarily require something in addition to what would take place in addition to what would happen in front of a three-judge panel. Parties have a right to present oral argument, and if it's going to be an en banc proceeding, it would
But that's been done. Didn't the parties present oral argument?
They have, and if your question is, does it require a second oral hearing, I would submit not, Your Honor.
That's not my question. My question is, that's what you suggested to us. You want this remanded for an en banc presentation.
Well, no, what we want is it remanded for an en banc consideration by the 10th District.
So that could be done in a conference-type setting with the members of the court participating, could it not?
It could be. In the federal circuits, it is done with either new oral argument, new briefing, or perhaps not. So it would certainly be, in our view, discretionary with the Court of Appeals that's going to be convening the en banc decision as to how that's going to be resolved.
What significance, then, should we give to the fact that the members of the 10th District have indicated that currently five of the eight, I think, have already signed off on one resolution?
Well, that's based upon the application of the McCoy decision. It's our contention that the McCoy decision was wrongly decided. The authority that the McCoy decision relied upon did not necessarily correctly and or in any manner address the question as to whether or not the six-year statute of limitations or the two-year statute of limitations should apply. It certainly would be possible that the judges who may have relied upon McCoy could be enlightened in an en banc setting to reconsider their views that they may have adopted in other decisions. I think that's the prerogative of any appellate judge to change their mind. Two judges of the 10th District have not been heard on this issue since McCoy was decided, although I would point out that Judge Tyak had sat on the Senegal decision, which is the decision that's in conflict with McCoy. So certainly I think that Judge Tyak holds a contrary view as to whether or not it's a six-year or two-year statute, and Judge Brown was not given an opportunity to express her views as to which statute should apply. Whether those two judges could in some way impress upon their colleagues that it is, in fact, the six-year statute that should apply, should be the ability to conduct an en banc decision or session so that could take place.
Thank you.
There are two issues that are before the court, and one is a constitutional issue. The constitutional provision that is involved here is Section 3A of Article 4 that provides that while historically three judges sat on each appellate districts, the legislature could add judges to appellate districts, and in fact all 12 districts at this point in time do in fact have in excess of three judges. And when that happens, there is a provision in Section 3A of Article 4 that says that three judges shall participate in the resolution of any appeal. It is our contention that the reference to three judges deciding an appeal only sets the minimum number of judges that must participate, and that does not foreclose the possibility that more than three judges would.
Counsel, if you have a five-judge court or a six-judge court, internally they decide, well, three is just not enough to hear regular cases, so let's just hear them as a five-judge panel. Does the Constitution allow that?
If internally an appellate district were to decide to do that, I don't see there being any prohibition in the Constitution disallowing that. The reason that additional judges were added above and beyond the minimum three was to try to alleviate the workload in those appellate districts where the number of appeals had increased. It doesn't foreclose if an appellate district were to decide that they wanted all judges to participate in every single case, they could do that. But the language of the Constitution prohibits a party from insisting that an appellate district utilize all judges in deciding the case. It only ensures the litigants that three judges and no less than three judges will hear the case, but doesn't command that more than that number hear the appeal. So the resolution that we're proposing is in conformance with what we think is the logical interpretation of the constitutional language.
If I read the briefs correctly, you're both actually in accord on the en banc proceeding. It's just how the right to remand or whether the trial court or the appellate court has to set up a procedure first. You disagree on how it's to be applied, but the principle and the idea that there's only a minimum and it doesn't prevent the en banc, you both seem to agree on that, do you not?
That is correct. It really, the second issue is what seems to be the dispositive issue before the court, which is, does the actions of the 10th District here in refusing to en banc the case, once it in fact recognized that there was this conflict between Senegal and McCoy, whether or not that is sufficient to require a remand in this case. We would submit that it is. The argument that the Attorney General makes that it can't be done until there's an authorizing rule, either from this court or from a local court, as to how that procedure is to take place, defeats the whole purpose of what this court held in Ray J.J., which in fact used the language that appellate districts are duty-bound to conduct en banc decisions. It's our view that there could be no clearer expression from this court as to what the rule is. How procedurally that is done may necessitate some tweaking with local rules or this court, which has the authority to articulate an amendment to the appellate rules, would certainly clarify how that procedure is to take place, but it in no way prohibits the 10th District in this case from embanking the case on remand.
Mr. Fitzgerald, in Ray J.J., though, related to decisions issued by various panels within a very short period of time, I think we were talking
same
the
day.
Matter the same day, so there was no question that we were talking about resolving the law for that district. Here, it seems like your suggestion is almost litigant driven, to say that if a litigant requests it, the court must sit en banc. Is that what you're advocating here?
Not unless there's a conflict that is clearly on an issue of law.
But your conflict is very spaced out well in time.
I would submit that the temporal time frame between the decisions should not be controlling. In fact, in a case that came out shortly after In Re J.J., the case of In Re C.F., also involved a conflict in the 8th Appellate District where the opinions were issued. I think it was a couple of weeks apart. Certainly not the length of time that we have here between Senegal and McCoy, but the concern is that there is, in fact, a conflict that has developed, whether it is based on two decisions that were announced on the same day or a year apart or 10 years apart shouldn't matter. The courts, the attorneys, the bar, the public in general are not able to predict what the law is if you've got two competing decisions that come out with the contrary legal conclusion. Here,
if we're talking, though, about the court determining whether there is a conflict within the district, doesn't that make more sense? We have, say, a precedent of one case and a panel then duty-bound to follow precedent, for example, making a second decision Shouldn't it be up to the court itself to determine whether there are two live lines of precedent that are butting up against each other, rather than having a litigant say, well, Judge, there's this old case out here, and this panel didn't consider it, but this panel did?
Well, I would submit that ultimately it is the Court of Appeals that would decide whether there is a conflict between two decisions from that district. What's unique about this case is the 10th District did find a conflict. In paragraph 5 of the original opinion in this case, the 10th District expressly recognized that Senegal and McCoy were in conflict, that Senegal had never been overruled by any decision of the 10th District, and that it held that the 6-year statute of limitations applied to employment discrimination cases against the state, whereas McCoy held that it was a 2-year statute. And so here we have the unique fact where the Court of Appeals has indeed recognized a conflict. Despite that, they refused then to embank it. So,
but wasn't it because they felt it was a settled matter of law in the district? They recognized there was this outlier case there, but they said the rule in this district, and we have followed this rule, that there would be no change if there was even an en banc procedure.
But under In Re JJ, the moment there is a conflict, requires there to be an en banc session convened. A three-judge panel can't dispose or dispense with the need for an en banc proceeding, but simply by its own fiat of saying we're not going to recognize that other case, or we feel that the intervening decisions of this court come to a contrary conclusion.
Wasn't the operative rule in JJ to resolve the conflict within the district? And as I read the 10th District here, they're saying there is a resolution. There may have been this conflict, you may look at it as a conflict, but we have resolved it, and our current cases are taking this position, which again is contrary to your client.
But that allows for a three-judge panel to always circumvent In Re JJ.
Doesn't that necessarily mean that the next three-judge panel can overturn what the previous one did with regards to Senegal? So it can be a never-ending cycle depending on the makeup of the three-judge panel.
Absolutely, Justice O'Connor. And that's the concern here, is that we have two judges who have not yet expressed a view. Judge Tyak has expressed a view. Judge Brown has not. If they sit on the next panel that hears a case where the argument is that it should be the 6-year statute of limitations, the likelihood is very much that they could come, at least two judges would agree that it's a 6-year statute, and we're back to Senegal.
What do you understand the law to be in the 10th District on that substantive law today?
Clearly under McFadden, a three-judge panel has reversed Senegal. The question is, did they have the authority to do that in order to resolve an inter-district conflict? In Re JJ says that a three-judge panel does not have that authority once there is a conflict. And our view is that as much as McFadden attempted to say that Senegal was no longer the law, and to the extent that they had not yet overruled it, the three-judge panel that decided McFadden was going to say what the law is.
Do you read JJ to impose an en banc proceeding every time an appellate panel decides to deviate from its past precedent?
That issue is not here for the court today.
Well, I'm just wondering what your view is on the subject so we can explore
the topic. And I'm
going
to answer your question. I know there is a case that's going to be argued here next month, State versus Kalish, where that precise issue is before the court. But I would submit, Justice O'Donnell, that it would be inconsistent to say that it needs to be embanked to resolve a conflict, and yet allow a three-judge panel to do, in essence, the very same thing. So I think practically speaking, yes, and banc, if embank is going to be required, it does lead to the conclusion that a three-judge panel cannot overrule prior precedent on its own.
Counsel, you said if en banc is required, what if we were to say that en banc is permitted by the Constitution and it's a matter for the local court to determine if it wishes to have an en banc procedure?
Well, to do that, I think this court would have to would overrule In re JJ, because In re JJ doesn't say that it's permissible for the Court of Appeals to create some sort of procedure that perhaps could be used to embank the case. It says it is duty bound to embank the case. Now, what procedure is used in terms of briefing, timeframes, oral argument, things of that nature certainly can be resolved discretionary with the Court of Appeals by way of local rule or otherwise. But certainly, In re JJ imposes a duty on the Court of Appeals to convene en banc decisions.
All of these questions seem to me to emphasize the fact that this is a topic that's ripe for rulemaking. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely,
Your rulemaking Honor. By the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Whether we give discretion to the Court's appeals or not to do, but does it seems to me that there need to be some rules here.
Absolutely, and I see that my time is may I just answer your question,
please?
Absolutely, and there has been a proposed rule put forth by the Supreme Court's Rules Commission, and it's been held in abeyance pending the decision in this case. And we would certainly recommend that rulemaking process take place.
The federal circuits have
en banc rules,
yes,
that I think
would seem to work fairly well.
They seem to.
That's my impression.
So thank you, Your Honor.
In case your time has expired, I'd like to ask you this question, because I'm going to ask it of other counsel. Although the federal history is a little different than our history because of conflicting statutes, of which the en banc was derived from, do we even really need to wade into these muddy constitutional waters here? Can't this court, on its discretionary jurisdiction, accept a case under its matter of public or great general interest when a appellate district is in conflict, if a counsel chooses to appeal and raise the jurisdictional issue with this court?
Absolutely, Justice Cup. En banc is not going to foreclose whether this court were to hear it, but I would submit that the mere possibility that discretionary review might be offered in a case to resolve an intra-district conflict shouldn't foreclose the ability of the district itself to resolve those problems. It may lessen the need to appear here and have this court do that for a particular district. And that was really the rationale for In re JJ. The court recognized that there is the certification process for inter-district conflicts, but that districts in amongst themselves should resolve their own conflicts.
Well, the certification, of course, is a mandatory jurisdiction with this court, but the other would be discretionary. And there are, of course, appellate districts that have an even number of judges in which they are evenly divided on some issues. And so en banc is not going to make any difference because they're split right down the middle.
It could, but the problem with waiting for this court to perhaps take a case in on a discretionary appeal leaves that law in that district somewhat in limbo until that happens, which could be several years before the case would either be decided by this court or for this court to even accept the case. That's precisely the dilemma that I think In re JJ was attempting to resolve, and I think did so appropriately. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Fitzgerald. Mr. Miser.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, Ben Miser for Cleveland State University. The university believes the question is a close one, but we agree with Mr. McFadden that indeed the Ohio Constitution allows the courts of appeals to hear cases en banc. Nonetheless, Mr. McFadden is not entitled to the en banc hearing he seeks here today.
Before you move into that part of it, let me ask you the question. If your theory is that a three-judge panel is a minimum, would your response be the same, that if you have a six-judge Court of Appeals, that they could decide that they're going to hear every criminal case with a five-judge panel rather than a three-judge panel, if that's what they want to do?
No, Your Honor, I don't agree with Mr. McFadden's or Mr. Fitzgerald's answer to that question. The constitutional language might permit that practice, but the practice would not be consistent with the purpose of the language. And interpreting an ambiguous constitutional or statutory language, this court always is trying to give effect to the purpose of the provision. The purpose of this provision, which was added to the Constitution in 1959, was to increase the efficiency and administrability of the Ohio judiciary. At that time, the two appellate districts were overtaxed. The 10th and the 8th districts in Cuyahoga and Franklin counties were considering nearly 40% of the appellate caseload. And those six judges in those two districts were overworked. And so the voters of the state added the provision in order to allow those districts to manage their caseloads. But it then added the three-judge language to make clear that the three-judge panel was the traditional practice, and that would remain the traditional practice. But en banc review was also a traditional practice. In 1959, when the language was added, en banc review was very familiar to the federal judiciary. And so the language that we are looking at here today doesn't contemplate five-judge panels as a routine matter. It contemplates three-judge panels as a routine matter and en banc review in exceptional cases.
And the en banc review is derived essentially from the federal practice, because as you well know, the history of the federal courts and the state courts diverge a little bit, and the key case involved resolving a conflict in federal statute, which is not present in the Ohio Constitution.
That's correct, Your Honor, and the language, the textile mills decision rested on different language. But the language here is ambiguous as to whether or not en banc review is appropriate. Because if you look at the two sentences at issue, the first one talks about the fact that the General Assembly may add additional judges to overtaxed districts, appellate districts. And the second language then says that three judges shall participate in ordinary panel hearings in those districts. And this court has repeatedly said that shall is usually mandatory, but occasionally it is permissive, and Black's Law Dictionary confirms that.
So the basic theory is here, if there's a necessity that we determine is a necessity, we can deviate from that language.
I don't believe
it's traditional practice. It was just three-judge panels, but we're determining there's a necessity, so we can do something different.
Our position is that the language is ambiguous and is capacious enough to permit courts to sit en banc, since that is a traditional practice. But I would underscore that we do believe that the language is that it's a close question, and it certainly is a more than plausible reading to conclude that it doesn't permit en banc panels. But even if the court does conclude that en banc review is permitted by the Constitution, it's not permitted in this case, because neither this court nor the 10th District Court of Appeals had in place a rule that authorized en banc proceedings. Mr. McFadden says that JJ counts as a rule, but the Modern Courts Amendment sets forth the procedures by which this court and the lower courts promulgate rules, and JJ was not trying to promulgate a rule. JJ was talking about a particular circumstance. In In re JJ, this court explained that the 8th District could have and should have sat en banc, and that is because, as the court made clear in paragraphs 19 and 20 of the JJ opinion, the 8th District had in place a rule that authorized en banc proceedings. And in fact, that rule said that when a subsequent panel wishes to issue an opinion that conflicts with another panel, the presiding judge of that panel should ask the administrative judge to convene an en banc proceeding. That's what should have happened in JJ, and the 8th District didn't do that according to its own rules. So the JJ opinion said that the 8th District erred. This court wasn't saying that other districts that have no rules should be sitting en banc without a rule. All it was saying is that when the 8th District issued conflicting opinions on the same day on the same question.
But the syllabus language is pretty broad, is it not, in JJ? Appellate courts are duty bound to resolve conflicts within their respective appellate districts through en banc proceedings. It wasn't just applying to the facts in JJ. It was quite a broad statement by the court, is it not?
Yes, Your Honor, the syllabus language is broad.
We need a rule to affect that language. Why do we need a rule to implement the language of the Constitution?
Well, I think a lot of the questions here this morning, Your Honor, point up the fact that if a court of appeals were to sit en banc without a rule, there would be all kinds of questions about how that en banc proceeding should proceed, whether the prior panel's opinion would be vacated or whether it would stay in place if the district was evenly split. There are all sorts of satellite issues that would be addressed by a rule. But more to the point, the Modern Courts Amendment requires a rule for a proceeding that is not otherwise authorized. And this court just a month ago in State versus Simpkins explained that when a court does something that is not authorized by rule or by law, that unauthorized process is null and void. So Mr. McFadden is asking this court to order the 10th District to undertake an action that would be null and void absent
a
rule.
If it's authorized or directed by the Constitution, that's not good enough?
Your Honor, an en banc proceeding is not directed by the Constitution. The Constitution only says ambiguously that en banc proceedings might be proper, but they are proper only if there is then a subsequent rule. And this case, this court's case law concerning
authorized... The Constitution says that?
The Constitution says that that three judges shall participate, and so the Constitution says en banc proceedings are permissible, but it doesn't mandate them in any particular circumstance. And the JJ opinion was not saying that the Constitution commands en banc proceedings. The JJ opinion was saying that the 8th District should have convened an en banc proceeding given its own rule. And in paragraphs 19 and 20 of the JJ opinion, the court underscored the existing 8th District rule and explained that it should have been invoked there. And indeed, the court cited the Eisenberg opinion in which the 8th District had sat en banc to resolve a conflict pursuant to its standing rule. And so in citing the rule and in citing Eisenberg, this court in JJ wasn't setting a broad rule for all of the other districts. It was just speaking to the 8th District.
Well, the JJ syllabus is pretty clear. It doesn't say 8th District. It says appellate courts. If we took your position and we waited till an appellate court put their own rules in place, then those litigants don't have to follow, or that court doesn't have to follow JJ because they're just taking their time getting their rules?
That's correct, Your Honor, because the lower court wouldn't be able to do anything without an authorizing rule. And I think the JJ language was speaking to specifically the 8th District. But even in this case, suppose that the 10th District should have convened an en banc proceeding. That wasn't necessary in this case because there was no intra-district conflict for the 8th District to resolve. Mr. McFadden is relying heavily on the Senegal opinion, but Senegal was a dead letter long before Mr. McFadden ever came to court. On pages 18 and 19 of our brief, we cite a long line of opinions in which the 10th District had already made clear that it wasn't following the Senegal rule. Instead, it was applying the two-year statute of limitations, which clearly applies under the Court of Claims Act. And so by the time Mr. McFadden's claim accrued, it was clear that in the 10th District, the two-year statute of limitations applied, and that began with the Schaub case and extended through the other opinions cited in our brief. The McCoy case then additionally made clear that Senegal was a dead letter, and by the time it came to the McFadden case, the 10th District explicitly overruled Senegal, and prior panels, under the existing rules at the time, could overrule.
I don't quite understand why you're so objecting to this remand, because if you count votes, it looks like they could have a quick conference and the issue's resolved because they've got 5 votes for your position. So I don't understand why you're fighting the remand and the necessity for a rule so much. What is your objection?
The objection, Your Honor, is constitutional. The Modern Courts Amendment doesn't allow courts of appeals to undertake proceedings for which there aren't rules that set forth the process. There are a lot of satellite issues involved in an en banc proceeding, as I earlier referred to. And the 10th District, if it is to undertake en banc proceedings, needs the guidance either of this court or needs rules set forth by itself. For example, in the federal courts of appeals, when, for example, the Sixth Circuit determines to sit en banc, it vacates the panel opinion. If the Sixth Circuit then were to divide evenly, the presiding judgment would not be the earlier panel opinion; it would be the district court opinion. There's also questions of timing. What happens to the panel opinion, and when is the losing party obligated to come to this court to seek review by filing a notice of appeal? What's the date that that begins to run from? All of these satellite questions are questions that can be resolved by a rulemaking. And
Mr. Meiser, we have had a rule that was withdrawn pending this case, and you've also referred, as has opposing counsel, to the federal process. What would your recommendation be if this court were to adopt a rule?
Well, I think the specifics of my answer are probably better left to a rulemaking process, but certainly the Sixth Circuit rule provides very helpful guidance that is based on years of federal experience. The Attorney General's office did submit comments related to the promulgated rule that has now been withdrawn, but those comments are probably left for that process rather than in the context of a particular dispute.
But you're saying the Sixth Circuit rule would be helpful?
The Sixth Circuit rule is very well developed and would be extremely helpful.
Thank you.
Your Honor. And in fact, the Sixth Circuit rule is not only one that exists in under the Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 35, is the same for all of the federal circuits, and then the Sixth Circuit has its own internal operating procedures that provide even further guidance.
And that rule, those rules are promulgated pursuant to a statute enacted by Congress authorizing it, and we don't have that here. Let me ask you the question I asked opposing counsel, and that is, do we really even have to decide this constitutional issue? Could this court not as a policy or practice simply take on a discretionary appeal as a matter of public or great general interest cases or issues in cases in which there is a conflict in inter-district conflict rather than developing some new procedure to handle these, which may occur rarely?
Absolutely, Your Honor. This court certainly could take that course, and it would be perhaps consistent with the doctrine of constitutional avoidance not to reach a constitutional question. We felt obligated to answer the question posed by this case, but the court prior to In Re JJ had never commented on en banc proceedings, and it didn't seem to be a recurring or frequent problem in the appellate districts. But that is not to say that en banc proceedings are unconstitutional. We, of course, maintain that they are, but I think that they should be rarely used. And when they are used, this court should not sit in judgment as to the question of whether or not the lower court erred in not sitting en banc. I think that determination should be entirely within the discretion of the appellate district, just as it is in the federal courts.
Well, counsel, let me give you another view. My recollection is that back in time, this court became somewhat aggravated by the fact that we were getting a lot of certified conflicts, and the only real conflict was within one appellate district. There wasn't any conflict anywhere else in the world. And we took a dim view of that and said, you know, you folks need to get your own house in order. Isn't that an appropriate function of this court? And isn't that exactly what was going on in Ray JJ?
Your Honor, again, I would maintain the view that the JJ opinion was speaking to the 8th District and that
that may have been where most of this was happening.
And in that case, the 8th District had a rule that provided for the resolution of intra-district conflicts. And because the 10th District does not, the 10th District properly determined that it could not sit en banc. But if this court is of the view that the intra-district conflict problem is a pressing one, then the court has promulgated a rule and withdrawn it that could resolve the question. And it can be resolved through the rulemaking process rather than through this court's opinions.
Since you continue to press the court with respect to exercising our authority under the Modern Courts Amendment for rulemaking on a procedural issue, is it your view that the conflict issue be raised by the litigants mandating the court to conduct this procedure, or is this an inherent function of the judiciary recognizing that its opinion may be in conflict with precedent within that district, and it belongs then to the province of the court as opposed to the province of the litigants?
Your Honor, I think the answer is that both are true. The federal experience, again, provides guidance.
Yes.
There, a court of appeals can sit en banc sua sponte,
yes.
Or the litigants can suggest rehearing en banc. The U.S. Supreme Court in the Western Pacific case made clear that a litigant can't control whether or not an appellate court sits en banc. It can merely suggest an en banc hearing, and ultimately it is within the appellate court's discretion, either because it feels a need to sit en banc on its own or because the litigant has suggested such a thing.
And is that your view, that this then belongs inherently to the province of the court, subject to perhaps a litigant's suggestion of conflict, but resolution is with members of the appellate court?
That's exactly our position, Your Honor, yes.
Thank
and
you.
That's consistent with the purpose of both the Modern Courts Amendment and Article 4, Section 3 that we're talking about here today, which are designed to protect the province of the judiciary. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Miser. Mr. Fitzgerald, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just two quick points. The Modern Courts Amendment was not intended or designed to limit this court's ability to articulate procedural rules in its own opinions. We've cited several cases in our briefs where this court has articulated procedural things that need to be done by trial courts, courts of appeals, in terms of how they resolve issues. None of those run afoul of the Modern Courts Amendment. So as much as this court has the authority to invoke enact rules that affect procedure, it doesn't limit the court's authority. It merely limits the legislature's authority to regulate procedure.
Are you advocating a rule in this case then, Mr. Fitzgerald, or do you think that our decision in the JJ case is sufficient notice that it can either be done by local rule or courts should just do it in compliance with the directives of the opinion in JJ?
I think in Ray J is more than sufficient to tell courts of appeals what they need to do. How they enact that doesn't necessarily require a local rule. Certainly would be preferable. I agree with Mr. Miser. I think the federal rules are certainly a good starting point to look at for purposes of how to conduct those en banc proceedings. Could have been done here, but in Ray JJ, I think, is sufficient to tell courts of appeals what they need to do.
So is it a fair capitulation or a summation of your position, then, that based on JJ, this court should simply remand this case to the 10th District for compliance with our directive in JJ and have them resolve this issue?
That is correct.
And
whether they allow us to do more briefing or have an oral argument would be up to the 10th District at the point in time of the remand. That is correct. We seek a remand, Your Honor.
If there is not a rule, how does the bar know what the standard is? How does the court among its members know what its standard should be? There has to be a rule, doesn't there, eventually? If we're going to recognize that, which we already have, doesn't there have to be a rule so that, I mean, we have rules for everything else. It seems to me that the request or the court's own motion deciding to hear a case en banc needs to be pursuant to some standard, doesn't it?
Well, and I think in Ray J is sufficient to give that standard, that when there's a conflict on an issue of law, the court needs to convene an en banc
well,
process.
Except in Ray JJ, as you know, the court of appeals there has a rule.
The 8th District did at the point in time. It's the only district that does. But I would even suggest that the court look at the rule for the application for reconsideration. There really isn't much guidance in that rule in terms of how courts of appeals are conduct reconsideration. And that was the rule that was invoked in this case. And I think that it's courts have resolved the methodology for resolving reconsideration internally or by way of decision. And that's what's going to have to happen. This idea that there's all these satellite issues that this court should be concerned with in resolving this case, I would submit that, as Justice O'Donnell submitted, this case needs to be resolved on a very narrow basis. En banc is constitutional, and this case needs to be remanded. That's all this court needs to be worried about. What other satellite issues might come up down the road can perhaps be resolved by way of rulemaking or by way of decisions from the courts of appeals as en banc is employed, as has happened in the federal circuits. And with that, we would ask that the court reverse the 10th District and remand it for en banc session. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Fitzgerald. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.